Chapter 2 "Screw this," said Madsen, turning and climbing back down the grassy slope. "It's a waste of time." Carl Thonius nodded. They'd missed this beast moot by several weeks. The vast stockyards were empty. A bitter gale swept across the derelict pastures where the tents and cage pens had been pitched. Some rusting iron pegs and hoops and a copious amount of dried white dung were the only signs that this area had seen any life in years. The sky was grey and fast, sliced strata of cloud hurtling west across the salty margin, beyond which the dark ocean boomed and rattled. "We'll push south," Madsen said. Thonius nodded again, but realized she had been directing the words at Ahenobarb and Kinski. They were wandering the sparse moot space. The Psyker was saying something, but his voice was hindered by the wind. Ahenobarb hovered close to Kinski, waiting, watching.
"What did he say?"
Thonius asked, squinting. Madsen looked at him. The wind tugged at her white blonde hair.
"The usual Psyker crap, Mr. Thonius," she said.
The western banks was hard, saline country, a ragged hem where the great plains of Flint's largest continent met the uncharted sea. The planet boasted a few thriving colony cities down in the temperate south, but it was out here in the unforgiving west that the trade on which Flint prospered was conducted. Stock. Beast flesh. Meat. Dynasties of stockmen, drovers and herders, inhabited the great plains, dutifully following routes and trails established by their ancestors, driving the superherds. Straight horn, flange horn, demi-pachyderm, the behemoth tuskers. Drove dynasties specialized in one breed or another, catered their skills and disciplines to that breed, but all for the same purpose, driving them west each season for the beast moots along the western banks. Moot towns studded the broken coastline like buckles on a tangled belt. Droverville, Salthouse, Trail End, Hukestown, West Bank, West Trail, Endrover, Fleshton, Slaughterhouses, Ocean Point, Mailer's Yards, Beastburg, Great West Moot, Tusk Verge. To each one, at the close of each season, the stock was brought into market. Off-world traders thronged around each moot, landing their flyers and bulk lifters on the scorched commerce fields to inspect the best of the merchandise. Nail and Kara had headed up towards Hukestown and all points north. Thonius's team was covering the southern reach of the banks. The wind off the foreshore was picking up. Kiss was waiting for them by the half-track they'd leased from a drove specialist in West Bank. Thonius and the three ministry agents trudged down to join her on the bleak roadway. She was looking out to sea. The dark ocean was crashing in onto the rudely worn rocks, each wave impacting with a sound of shattering glass. They drove south along the coast highway, the sea on one side, the slipped, craggy land on the other. The road was unmetalled and raw. Several times they had to slow to overtake work gangs on foot. Some were freelance drovers, shabby in treated hides, trudging with decorated herd poles held aloft towards the next moot. They looked like troglodytes to Kiss, skin-clad, caked in dung and clay that had dried white, their leaders decorated with skulls and antlers. Other work gangs were slaughtermen, dressed in long, button-front black coats, and carrying the ritual chain blades and engraved beers stretchered over their shoulders. Their shaven faces were marked with finger-drawn patterns of blood. Kiss slowed and leaned out of the cab to question them.
"Beast moot?"
Their answers were contradictory and useless. They passed through empty, wind-blown coast towns. Endrover, Western End, Tally Point. The places had been scarred and eroded by the ocean's eternal blast, and now, out of moot season, were almost devoid of life. Tall grasses grew in the moot yards. The buildings were shackled up and boarded. Paint peeled. The great raised stockboards over the highway displayed fading chalk scrawls, costing last season's going rate for tusk bison. The towns were an odd mix, Big or small, wealthy or struggling, they followed the same essential pattern. Wide tracts of commerce fields for the off-world ships to land, wider and greater moot fields where the stock was penned and displayed, and little clutches of buildings, the town itself. Taverns and barter halls, constructed in the local style, using great curved beams as both wall posts and rafters, with a wattle and daub of mud straw and flakboard in between, sat alongside more modern, rock-crete-built rendering silos. Kiss wondered aloud where on this treeless plateau the locals had found the timber to raise the old barter halls.
"Not timber, tusks," Thonius said. "Some of these buildings are very old. Traditionally, they use the tusks of mature animals as frame ribs."
Kiss was driving. She slowed right down as they passed through Tally Point. The bare, yellowed ribs forming the superstructure of the weather-beaten town hall were 20 meters long.
"What kind of animal carries—"
"None. Not anymore," said Thonius. "The real big, mature bulls were all slaughtered centuries ago, during the early colonization. A bull has to live a good few hundred years to sport tusks like that. We'll not see their like again."
Kiss looked across at him. "But they still herd these things here."
Thonius nodded. "It's the key to Flint's economy. The big placental herbivores grow fast, put on a lot of mass. The Great Plains are lush. A demipachyderm can develop enough bulk to be worth slaughtering in under 5 years. But their tusks don't grow half as fast. Given the rate of supply and demand, this world will never see another giant bull with 18-meter tusks."
"The stuff you know," she chuckled.
He smiled back. "I know what every trade economist worth his salt knows, and what every slaughter baron on Flint chooses to ignore. At this rate of slaughter, Flint will be wasted out in another century." She realized there was nothing but grim finality in his smile.
"The stuff you know," she murmured again.
They pressed on south, through several dead towns that trade and life had already disowned. Fleshton, West Walkaway, Lingsburg. The yards there were totally overgrown, the drystone pen walls collapsed. In each town, the buildings were faded and abandoned. Kiss saw crumbling jetties and fallen-down piers, half overwhelmed by the ocean spray. Once the trade had come by sea, shipping the meat down to the southern cities on barges. Not anymore. There was a small moot in Mailer's Yards, and another in Hyde Barter. They spent a while in both, checking the moot's record books and ledgers for off-world buyers. The locals were far from compliant. Flint had no centralized record of its visitors. The moots compiled their own archives. Space traffic was deregulated. High orbit above Flint was filled with thousands of trading spaceships, none of which advertised its identity with a transponder. Only the ledgers of a town's baron could say who was around. Any trader who wanted to do business at a moot had to register himself. In the crowded marketplaces, amid the jostling shaman-like drovers with their clay-caked flesh and antlered heads, and the armored finery of off-world traders, sober-suited agents from the Departamento Munitorum went from dynast to dynast, performing the never-ending task of assessing trade for the purposes of imperial levy. There was noise everywhere. The chattering bark of the drovers bartering, the shouts of the stock auctioneers, the clatter of tally boards, and the constant background lowing of the vast flange-horn herds in the moot yards. Neither moot had any record of the ship they were after. In Mailer's Yards, Thonius and Madsen went into the barter hall to inspect the local baron's own archives. Kiss waited outside on the ivory decking with a henobarb and Kinski. The scrawny psycho went to the bone rail and stood, looking out across the jostling market towards the fuming sea. Kiss could feel a pinprickle of Sayus, but it was not directed at her. She wondered how many minds in that marketplace Kinski was idly rifling through. The facade of the barter hall glittered brilliantly every time the sun came out from behind the chasing clouds. It was covered with thousands of silver discs, each one about a thumb span in diameter, no two identical. They were all nailed in place. Fish scales, she realized, from some pelagic giant. They were as hard and simple as everything else on this beleaguered frontier, but somehow had a beauty that Flint did not. Ahenobarb had seen the scales, too. He reached out to take one down as a trophy, and then snatched back his hand. He glared at Kiss, sucking blood from sliced fingertips. The scale edges were razor-sharp. Kiss unhooked three using her telekinesis and floated them across to her. They glinted in the air. She hung all three over the top button stud of her body glove, using the nail holes in their centers. They shone like a badge of office at her throat. Thonius and Madsen emerged from the hall. They had learned nothing to their advantage.
"Except," said Thonius, "the Tusk Verge moot begins tonight."
The Tusk Verge moot was amongst the biggest held on Flint, almost on the scale of the Winter Great Moot and the Spring Drove. They drove the 60 kilometers to Tusk Verge through the late afternoon, and while they were yet some distance from the town, they saw the first signs of it. Initially, contrails in the cold, bright sky, criss-crossing lines of vapor that spoke of heavy inter-orbit traffic. Then a few flyers, shuttles zipping over, then a pair of battered bulk lifters that grumbled along overhead and blotted out the sun. The traffic on the highway got denser. Herdsmen, slaughtermen, a few troops of entertainers. Then caravans of slow-moving, high-sided wagons drawn by oxen or traction engines. The wind trailed back a chalky dust from the caravans that carried the sour bite of ammonia. There was money to be made from collecting up a herd's droppings and selling it on for phosphates and fertilizers. Colonies on mineral-poor worlds paid generously for Flint's excrement. Just 5 kilometers from the town, they saw greater clouds against the horizon, billowing from inland. They were white, like low mist rolling in banks, but they were dust. The dust of the superherds coming in down the ancient drove roads. The highway entered Tusk Verge over a stone viaduct 2 kilometers long. Beneath its broad arches, spread out on the wide coastal plains, was a portion of the moot's pens and gated yards, a giant patchwork of dry stone enclosures through which animals could be driven, penned off, separated, counted. High-walled droveways led up to the commerce fields, where the cargo haulers of the orbiting trade ships lined up to be filled. In the failing light, blue and yellow flares came intermittently from the direction of the commerce fields, the afterglow of landing jets and atmospheric drives. The stock was pouring into the town locale through the drove gates along the eastern perimeter. The ancient trackways and drove roads, scoured into the great plains by generations of herds, had been dug down through the coastal cliffs, forming high-flanked cuttings and gorges that funneled the incoming livestock down into the pens of the moot yards. Stockmen hauled on massive iron swing gates, directing one herd or herd portion into this pen, another into that. One dynast's animals were kept from another's, or a major herd was portioned down into commercial parcels. Brandsmen went from pen to pen, checking flesh brands and ear slashes for provenance and ownership, while tallymen collected up bronze tally rings of appropriate value from drove men and clattered them onto the abacus-like tally boards they carried. The rise and fall of stock values and the going rates for certain beasts of a certain weight were set by the slaughter baron and his cartel, based on the accumulated tallies, and then chalked up on the massive boards overlooking the auction arenas. Beyond them, lit by oil drum fires, stood the long halls where buyers could inspect sample animals, and then the long, grim silos of the rendering plant. Some traders bought dead meat and salted or froze it for shipment to the cheap food marts down sub. Others bought live and shipped it, sometimes in stasis, to more discerning clients on the wealthier hive worlds of Angelus. Some bought low quality in bulk, others high quality animals, individually chosen and purchased. Some came for the mechanically recovered meat products of the rendering plant, others for phosphate dung. A 10-ton demi-pack might fetch 20 crowns a ton, get turned into 30,000 meat patties to be sold at half a crown a time in the food stalls of a hive's slumhab. A 60-kilo shorthorn might fetch 5 times as much, because it was destined to sell as a prime imported delicacy in the up-hive restaurants of Eustace Majoris and Caxton at 50 crowns a pop. The fire drums lit the evening with greasy flames. The air was heady with the autumnal stinks of blood, dung, fire, herbivore gas, and baled feed. They pulled off the viaduct, parked the half-track in a Rock Creek yard where other trucks had been left, and went looking for the slaughter baron. Inevitably, the livestock trade up and down the Angelus sub overlapped the pit game business. Traders shipping a hold full of packs might as well make some extra fees carrying more dangerous animals for the imperial pits, and game agents in need of transport often hired stock traders because they already had a lot of the specialized holding equipment. The beast moots of Flint were primarily livestock-oriented. Occasionally, drovers brought a Great Plains predator to market for extra cash, but the commerce of the Western Banks was essentially about meat. Further up the line, out towards Lenk and the Rip Worlds, that was where you found the specialist beast moots, the ones held entirely for the pit trade. Even so, Flint's beast moots were frequented by the game agents. Some were passing through on their way to Lenk. Others came to buy cheap meat cuts for bait and feed. Many of the pit-favourite carnivores grew too placid if cargoed in stasis, and a full-grown taurosaur ate its own weight in meat several times over during 6 weeks' live haul. Some agents came to Flint to purchase big herbivores that could be goaded into violence for specialized bouts, and others yet came because they were travelling as paying passengers on livestock trade ships and had no say where the shipmaster put in. Baron Julius Carquin had run Tusk Verge for 60 years. In his rich, off-planet robes and lime-clayed animal-hide cloak, he seemed a man caught between two worlds, part businessman, part shaman. During the moot, he held court in one of the tusk-frame pavilions in the town centre. An entourage of slaughtermen, tallymen, and dynasts surrounded him, along with market advisers and record-keepers. Distinguished far traders were admitted to his presence. Many were greeted like old friends. Baron Carquin had done business with just about everybody. There seemed small hope of getting close to him, certainly not without causing an altercation and revealing their authority. Already, from the wary behaviour of officials at the smaller moots, Thonius had realised the folk of the Western Banks did not take well to imperial dealings. It was a free market, which depended on the goodwill of the rogue traders. The authority of the throne was not welcome. Kiss tried to bribe a junior ledger-keeper for information, but it hadn't worked. The Baron had great power here, particularly during the time of the moot. He wielded imperial authority by proxy. During a moot, a slaughter baron had more power in his town than the Lord Governor subsector. Carquin's face was craggy, and his frame big, made bigger by the weight of velvet, chainmail, and hides. His teeth were bad, his eyes hooded. On his head he wore a circle crown of bronze, mounted with 2 polished ram horns, an ancient badge of office. The crown was mostly lost in his unruly black hair, so it appeared the horns sprouted from Carquin's own brow. He had 4 of his many bodyguards by his side at all times. They were big men, dressed in the high button coats of the Slaughterman Guild, but their chain blades were designed for combat, not rendering. They wore bleached antlered beast skulls on their leather caps. The bodyguards saw to it that none but the most important clients got close to the Baron. "We're screwed at this rate," said Madsen. Thonius didn't think he'd ever met anyone so pessimistic.
"Let's press the issue," suggested Kiss.
"And get in a fight," Thonius said. Kiss shrugged. A henobarb, just a big shape in the firelight, seemed to approve. "There are ways," Kinski said sarcastically. He glanced at a henobarb, and immediately the big man reached out to catch Kinski as he fell.
"What's he doing?" Thonius hissed.
Kiss took a couple of rapid steps backwards and covered her mouth in shock. The raw, unleashed surge of psi power had taken her off balance.
Shit, she gasped. He's gone. Left his body.
What? Thonius said. Kiss pointed through the bustling crowd towards the great gaggle of people collected around Carquin on the baronial dais at the end of the hall.
I can feel him. Hunting, Kiss said.
Get him back here, Thonius said to a Henobarb.
Kinski knows what he's doing, Madsen said stonily. If we leave this up to you, we'll be here all week.
This is the Inquisitor's operation, Thonius growled. You three are here under sufferance.
Whatever, said Madsen, and looked back into the crowd.
Thonius stared too, but he could see nothing out of the ordinary. What was Kinski doing?
That ledger keeper, just behind Carquin, on the left, whispered Kiss.
Thonius found the man. Pale, old, wearing long, lime-caked robes and a necklace of bull's teeth. The old man had turned from a trencher of food and was leafing through the tanned skin pages of one of the massive ledger books. Each volume took two men to carry. They sat on ivory stands around the baron's dais. The ledger keeper speed-read each page he turned, with blank eyes. Abruptly, the ledger keeper backed away from the volume, blinking and disorientated. Kinski lurched and opened his eyes.
They're not here, but they were expected, he said.
What? Asked Thonius.
Captain Thekla of the October country is a regular visitor to this moot. The Baron has prepared accommodation for him and reserved several herd parcels that he believed Thekla would be interested in.
So we are wasting our time here, Kiss began.
Kinski grinned at her.
There is an interesting part to this. According to the records, the Baron knew Thekla wasn't coming this season, because Thekla's apologies and regrets were passed on to the Baron this morning by a stock trader called Bartol Siskind.
Who is?
Master of the rogue trader Allure, and currently in the auction pens, bidding for Flangehorn.
They spread out into the crowds in the firelit night. Moving into the shadows of a doorway, Thonius touched his wraithbone pendant and made contact.
The October country isn't here, and it isn't coming, but we've got a lead on another shipmaster it may have had recent dealings with.
Details? Ravenna replied.
Bartol Siskind, of the Allure. Kinski got the information out of a local mine.
I felt it from here. We will be asking Mr. Kinski to be more circumspect. He is powerful, but also crude. An incident here would be regrettable.
Indeed, said Thonius.
He glanced round. A couple of ragged drovers had just gone by, glaring maliciously at the off-worlder in the shadows, talking to himself.
I'd better go. We're going to see what we can get out of this Siskind once we find him. You'd better recall Harlan and Kara to the ship.
I will. Be careful, Carl.
Thonius made his way through the crowd. Despite the gale off the sea, the night was warm. 400,000 head of stock generated a significant amount of heat. And smell. Already, Thonius's favorite buckle-back boots were ruined from the dung swilling the streets. He wafted his kerchief in front of his nose. Staccato shouts echoed from the vast bowls of the auction arenas. Bidding was in progress. Confident, experienced-looking shipmen in winter coats, cloaks, or body armor leaned at the bone rail and held up numbered cards, as a dozen of the hugest quadrupeds Carl Thonius had ever had the misfortune to smell were circled in the paddock below. But there was another source of commotion above the chatter of the crowd. It was coming from behind him, back from the direction of the Baron's pavilion. Casually, Thonius took up a place on the nearest arena's overstage. The man next to him was a brawny redhead in a body glove and heavy cloak.
"What's that about, do you suppose?"
Thonius asked idly, nodding back in the direction of the pavilion. The shipman scowled.
"Some frigger brought a psyker. Got into the head of one of the Baron's people. Carquin's gone friggin' nuts, so the whole moot's gonna slow right down until the fuss dies away."
The man swore again.
"I'm meant to be in Caxton in 8 days with a hold full of sirloin," he complained.
"A psyker," said Thonius.
"That's not good."
"Of course it's not good," the shipman blustered. "Everyone knows they're banned from the moots. Moot law. No psychers on account of unfair trading. Always been that way. That's why the Baron's got his warlock."
Of course that's why the Baron's got his warlock, Thonius thought. Of course. Of course. And everyone knows that psychers are banned from the moot by ancient decree. Of course they do. Of frigging course. He could hear Kiss saying it. The stuff you know. Well, it turns out this wasn't one of them. Come to that, he hadn't even seen a warlock.
"What the hell have you done?"
the shipman asked him suddenly. Thonius started. Was the look of dismay on his face that obvious? But that's not what the shipman had meant. He looked down, over the ivory rail, into the street. One of the Baron's bodyguards was down there, chainblade in hand. Two ragged drovers were busy pointing out the man they'd seen talking to himself.
"Oh, shit," said Thonius.
Triple shutters secured the holding cell. I waited as they opened in series. Vertical doors, then horizontal barriers, then an inner skin of verticals again, all sliding back into the recesses of the armored frame. Then I moved through into the dingy cell. Dubow looked up at the light and at me, and groaned. He was tethered to the floor by a long chain that was fixed to his bracelet cuffs. The chain had enough length on it to allow him to lie on the straw pallet in the corner or use the chemical toilet. He was dirty and unshaven. A tray lay by the door, a half-eaten meal on it.
"You again," he said. "Me again." Get used to it, I thought. But for the information he might yet yield, most inquisitors I knew would have had Dubow executed by now. He was criminal scum, exploiting the systems of imperial society just to corrupt it. He was also a strange one. He had no discernible mind talents, but parts of his brain were unreadable. I had interviewed him a dozen times in the 6 days since we'd set out from Eustace. His mind had become ever more impenetrable. It also seemed as if he had been getting stupider.
"What is it you want me to confess to now?"
he asked, getting up on his knees. I made no response. Dubow stood up, tired but somehow triumphant.
"Okay," he slurred. "Okay, I admit it. I'm Horus, reincarnated. I am the arch-enemy of the Golden Throne. I am..."
"Shut up." He fell silent and stared at the floor. To begin with, Carve Master Dubow had been quite forthcoming. He had owned up to his part in the narcotic trade, explained how he had abused his position as an importer to circulate contraband into the subculture of Petropolis. During our second interview, he had been quite forthcoming on the subject of his sources. A number of rogue traders who had dealings with the Imperial Pits supplied him with prohibited substances along with pit beasts. The Widdershin secured him Obscura and Gladstones at a decent rate. The Fontainebleau brought in Grinweed and Yellowds. The Macrocosme had been good for both. Dubow had been perfectly placed to distribute, thanks to his connections with the Moody clans and the Gamesters. I had already passed all three names on to my masters in the Ordo's Helican. Others could deal with it. It had taken longer to fox the October country out of him. That was where the flects were coming in from. Dubow finally sold out his contact, Fever Sko, and the complicity of the October country's master, Thekla. But he insisted he didn't know where Sko and Thekla were getting the flects from. That was where the mind wall went up. I probed him for a moment. For the third or fourth time, all I got was a mysterious memory echo. Contract 13.
"Tell me about the allure."
He winced.
"The what?"
"The allure."
He shrugged.
"It's a ship. It does the length run. It's brought me beasts a few times."
Hovering, I circled around him slowly.
"It's Captain. A friend of Sko's?"
"No."
"Thekla, then?"
A shrug.
"Yeah, Thekla. Old ties. Trader bonds.
All buddies together. They're allies. That's how rogue traders work.
Did the Master of the Allure ever supply you with flecks?
Siskind? No.
Did the Master of the Allure ever offer to supply you with flecks?
No.
I stabbed a mind lance into Dubot's midbrain, and he swayed in pain. It was like pushing a sword into wet paper. His mind seemed so mushy.
What else can you tell me about Siskind and the Allure?
Dubot rocked.
Siskind is Thekla's third cousin. They're both related by blood to Lillian Chase.
I was momentarily stunned. Lillian Chase had been an abominable blight on the Imperium 80 years before. A radical of the Recongregator philosophy, she had foregone her Ordo loyalties and founded the Cognitae school on Hesperus. There, for 3 generations, she had hard-schooled the brightest and best that had fallen into her clutches and formed them into sociopathic monsters, driven by a will to undermine the fabric of the Holy Imperium. The Cognitae had only come to an end thanks to a purging raid led by Lord Inquisitor Rorkan, now Grand Master of the Ordo's Helican. Damn, Moloch himself had been a product of that deranged academy. I became aware that my contact alarm was piping. I retreated from the cell and keyed the hatches to shut after me. Medike Zarjaran was waiting for me outside.
"What's the trouble?" I asked him.
"I'm concerned, sir, only for the prisoner's welfare," he said.
"And so?"
"Dubot's mind is fraying," he said. "He is dying. I'm afraid it's because of the repeated interrogations."
"Medike, I've gone easy on him. 12 interviews, no more than that."
"I understand. But when Mr. Kinski's sessions are added in..."
"Mr. Kinski's sessions?" I had forgotten myself. My frank mind claws had quailed him. The short, olive-skinned Medike cowered back from me. "My apologies," I said. "Please confirm. Kinski has been interviewing the prisoner too."
"Yes, sir," said Zarjaran timidly. "He and Mamsel Madsen, 2 times a day.
What the hell was this? I turned my chair automatically to roam up to the bridge and demand answers out of Priest. But Hellstrom was standing directly behind me.
"Yes.
My Lord Inquisitor, I summoned you out of your interview. There's a situation down on the surface." Patience Kiss shouldered her way through the massing crowds, thankful of the camouflaging flicker of the firelight, looking back and forth for Thonius.
"This is bad," she said.
But instead of Ravenna's voice, she got the gruff mind drawl of Kinski.
"Yes, it's bad. Get your ass in gear. We are leaving."
"Where are you?"
"The ride. Get a move on."
Gongs and what sounded like kettle drums were sounding out now from various parts of the torchlit town. The noise caused a stir, an agitation in the already unsettled moot crowds. Everywhere she looked, slaughtermen were moving through the throng. The baron's bodyguards, their strength supplemented by regular meat cutters from the rendering silos.
"Carl, where are you?"
No response. She repeated the query using her pocket fox. Still nothing. She hurried down Tusk Verge's busy main street in the direction of the highway viaduct. Overhead, the night sky was underlit amber by the smoke and campfires of the town. A large, slender sickle moon hung high in the west. A slaughterman's moon, it was called, announcing moot time, because it resembled both a butcher's stripping blade and a long ivory tusk. Carl had told her that. The stuff he knew. The drumming became more incessant. Then she heard a fierce, rasping whoosh. She looked round. A blood-red full moon seemed to be rising above the town, rising fast. But it wasn't a celestial body at all. It was a globe balloon, trapped in a thick woven net that stretched down beneath its spherical bulk to suspend an ivory basket. The rasping, whooshing sounds came from the brief, bright squirts of flame from the burner as it rose. The basket trailed a cable down to the ground. There was a man in the basket, a Dynast drover, by the look of him. His body was caked in white clay except for dark coal rings around his eyes, and he wore a headdress of antlers. He had a bone rattle in each hand, and he shook them and pointed them down into the crowd. Kiss had seen this man before, in the barter hall. The Baron's warlock. His shaman. Evidently a psyker himself. Kiss could feel her flesh goosebump. He had gone aloft to locate the interloper. The balloon rose no higher than 10 meters. Its tether was fixed to a cart that the baronial bodyguards were wheeling through the streets to move their warlock bloodhound around. Kiss started to run. She reached the Rock Creek yard where they had left the half-track. The three Petropolitan agents were already aboard, and Madsen had the engine running.
"Come on!" Kinski called.
"Where's Thonius?" she asked.
Kinski shrugged.
"Like I give a damn. We've got to leave town now before things get ugly."
"We're not leaving him behind," Kiss said. "You want to take the whole frigging place on?"
Madsen called. "Look, I don't like leaving a body on the ground either, but frankly, sister, better him than all of us.
The Baron will have us ritually shredded if he gets hold of us. Shit, Thonius is probably already dead. Where will your precious Inquisitor's mission be if we all end up as dog mints?"
"Are you freaking well going to get aboard or not?" Kinski asked.
"No," said Kiss. "And if you drive out of here now, next time I see you, I'll kill the lot of you."
Ahenobarb laughed. Madsen threw the half-track into gear.
"You stay here, Kiss, and there won't be any next time."
Kiss stepped back as the vehicle lurched forward. It pulled a wide turn and then thundered away across the torchlit viaduct. Kiss watched it go and then turned back into the town. Thonius started to run. He could see the balloon and the ghastly capering freak in its basket. More importantly, he could hear the shouts and cries in the crowd behind him as the Slaughterman bodyguard pushed his way through to reach him. His heart was pounding. This wasn't fair. It just wasn't fair. He didn't deserve this. He knew running was making him stand out. He might as well have been holding up a sign saying, "Here I am, the guilty one." But still he ran. The bodyguard had got a good look at him. All he could see in his mind's eye were the polished teeth of the man's chain blade. Most people got out of his way. Nobody wanted a piece of this trouble. A few, tallymen and stockmen mostly, cried out and pointed, alerting his pursuers. There was a junction ahead. Straight on was the bustling main street, to the right a short drystone alley that led to a staircase down into the moot pens. He kept going straight. If he could get to the street, then he could reach the yard. Reach the vehicle. They'd be waiting for him, with the engine running. Hands grabbed at him. Three filthy drovers had decided they weren't just going to stand by and watch some outsider get away with breaking their most inviolable laws. Shouting out, they clawed at his coat. One had his left arm pinned. "Get off me!" he wailed. One thumped him across the side of the head to shut him up. The drover had bone rings on his dirty fingers, and the hard edges stung and drew blood. Thonius could feel it dribbling down the side of his face. Carl Thonius hated physical combat. He didn't look like much of a threat, either. He appeared too fragile, too slight, especially compared to combat specialists like Nail and Zef Mathewin. Certainly he saw himself more as a thinker, a tactician. He tended to leave what he called the fisticuffs to his more brawny comrades. But in truth, Carl Thonius was a trained throne agent, an ordo interrogator. The fact that Harlan Nail could kill him with a single cough obscured the fact that Thonius was still far, far more capable than the average man on the street. This street included, it was to be hoped. The drovers holding him were whip-thin and strong. The pursuing bodyguard could only be a few paces off now. Thonius was not physically powerful, but he fought with a canny combination of brains and vicious dexterity. He went limp, and his assailants relaxed slightly, assuming him to be submitting to their efforts. It was easy, therefore, to snap himself sideways, freeing his pinned arm. He back-kicked the drover behind him in the shins and jabbed his fingers into the eyes of the dynast, breathing rancid halitosis in his face. The man screamed. Thonius danced away, ducked a flying fist from the third drover, and pirouetted neatly to kick him in the gut. Two were down, one doubled over and retching, the other on his knees, hands clamped over his injured eyes. The third came in, roaring hoarsely, slashing with an ivory dagger. Thonius dodged to the man's right, caught his stabbing wrist with his left hand, and broke the drover's humerus against his right forearm with a scissoring block and yank. Some of the off-world traders in the immediate vicinity cheered. They didn't care about the outcome. A decent street fight was an entertainment to be enjoyed. There was a revving sound, the noise of a chain blade kicking into life. In his high-buttoned black coat, the pursuing bodyguard stormed into view, his powered ceremonial weapon whining as it swung and circled in expert hands. Thonius jumped backwards, and the alarmed crowd retreated wide to avoid the oscillating chain blade. Thonius could hear the warlock freak up in his basket, shaking his rattles fit to bust, screaming that the rogue was found. The bodyguard came in, blade shrilling. Thonius feinted left and then went right, pausing to rip the antlered headdress off one of the fallen drovers as he did so. As the bodyguard came round for a second try, hefting his cumbersome weapon, Thonius had the antlers held out before him with both hands, like the beast tamers he'd seen in the circus, warding off big felids with the legs of a stool. The bodyguard chopped with his chain blade, and 50 centimeters of brittle antler tree sheared away in splinters. The force nearly tore the headdress out of Thonius's hands. Another pass, and now both antlers were cut down. A drunken shipman in the circle of onlookers cheered and clapped, and the bodyguard glanced around with a murderous glare. Thonius took the opportunity as it was given. He lunged forward and stabbed the sawn-off antlers deep into the slaughterman's neck. It was horrible and messy. Blood squirted out and drizzled the crowd, which backed away sharply with disgusted complaints. The slaughterman fell on his front, his limbs convulsing. He landed across his own tearing chain blade, and a great deal more blood erupted into the air. All the rough good humour was gone now. No more clapping, no more cheering. This wasn't bare-knuckle chop and punch. A man was dead. Thonius threw the dripping headdress aside. He started on towards the main street. But now there were three more slaughtermen running up towards him from that direction. One had a chain blade, another a butcher's axe. The third was wielding a long, bronze-bladed drover lance. For a brief moment, Thonius considered reaching into his left-hand coat pocket and pulling out his Ordo Rosette. He pictured himself holding it up and declaring, "By the order of the Imperial and Holy Inquisition, and by the authority of the Ordo Xenos Helican and Inquisitor Gideon Ravener, I command you to desist and submit." Would that stop a lance and an axe and a chainer? Would the sworn and blooded mootkin of an august and almost deified slaughter baron even recognize the authority? Thonius decided the answer was no. He had no desire to end his career with a raised rosette in one hand, a meaningless declaration on his oh-so-pretty lips, and a bronze lance through his torso. So he reached into his right-hand coat pocket instead. All bets were off now. Will Tallowhand, God Emperor rest his soul, had given Carl Thonius the Hecuta VI the day Thonius had achieved the rank of interrogator. Kara Swole had given him a not entirely unpleasant hug, and Nora Sandjack had presented him with a silver charm showing St. Kyodris inspiring the hosts. Nail had given him a pat on the arm and a few inspiring words, and Ravener had given him a first edition of Solon's writings. The book was on a shelf in his cabin aboard the Hinterlight. He still wore the charm. Nail's comradely pat and heroic words and Kara's hug were cherished memories with zero practical application. On balance, right then, in that dusty side street, Tallowhand's gift seemed the most lasting and provident. Will had warned him the Six had a beefy kick. Thonius knew it. He trained with the gun on the Hinterlight's range, exhausting hundreds of clips for 10-0 groupings. This was the first time, in anger. The Hecuta VI was a handmade piece. The body and slide were brushed chrome, the grip sanitized black rubber, machined out to fit his hand. It formed an inverted L-shape because the grip housing, built to contain an 18-round clip, was longer than the polished body. The safety off was a steel rocker that the thumb depressed automatically when the weapon was gripped. When it was discharged, white flame burped from the snout, and the slide banged back and forth, flinging out the spent case with a chime like loose change. The buck recoil wrenched his wrist. It was so frigging loud. Thonius realized he'd only ever shot it with ear protectors on. The crowd broke and fled. The slaughter man with the lance jerked back 4 or 5 meters, his face missing. The man with the chain blade did likewise, tumbling over on the cobbles. The axe man turned to flee. It was all too easy to put a round through the back of his head. Such force. Such monumental destroying force. The axe man spun over, his face hitting the paving first with a wet crunch. Thonius gasped and raised the Hecuta to a ready-stroke-armed position. His wrist ached. His mind was racing. He heard someone growl a curse and saw one of the retreating shipmen turn, wrenching an 8-shot heavy revolver from his ermine-edged coat. Yes, all bets were off. Thonius didn't wait. He put a bullet through the shipman, too. Kiss, already running, jumped when she heard gunfire echo down the streetway. It was distant, muffled. A street away? Two? More? All around her, the moot crowd was breaking and scattering, fleeing the killing zone. Drovers and moot men ran, panicking. Shipmen and off-world traders were more leisurely, returning to their vehicles, heading back to their ships on the commerce fields. Some had weapons drawn just in case, and the richest had their lifeguard carders locked and loaded. The Tusk Verge moot was certainly suspended. There was evidently going to be hell to pay for the disruption. As she ran, against the tide, Kiss could see the warlock in his balloon, heading towards the auction rings and the gates into the pens. She didn't dare risk telepathy now.
"Carl, in the name of the God Emperor, Thonius, where are you?"
No response. She halted under the eaves of a barter hall and self-tested her vox. It was live, all right.
"Carl?"
"Kiss, you out there? I need a hand. I really do," Thonius called.
He was running down the stinking stone stairs into the unlit pens. Above and behind him, the street was alive with tumult and firebrands. He stopped for a moment in the shadow of a dry stone wall and reached into his coat for his microbead, tracing the tiny plastic-sheathed wires from his earpiece to the compact set in his pocket. The wires had been torn out, presumably when the drovers had manhandled him. His heart was still beating fast. He checked his weapon. The tiny LED display informed him he still had 14 rounds left, and he had another clip in his hip pocket. The smell and the darkness had become alarming. There was no light down in the penyards, just stink. Massive, heavy bodies jostled in the stalls. He was splashing through pools of urine, tripping on raked-up rafts of straw, mud, shit.
"I really frigging want to know the way out of here," he said.
"Relax, Carl. It'll be all right." Thonius smiled as Ravenna's voice floated into his head. He could feel the warm glow off his wraithbone pendant. A bobbling line of torches was making its way into the penyards in the dark. They were coming after him. Thonius could hear shouting voices, gunning chain blades.
"Help,"
he said. "Ahead, 20 paces.
"Right,"
he obeyed. It brought him up against a solid iron gate. "Open the gate."
"What?"
"Open the gate, Carl."
"You expect me to go into a pen full of frigging Tuskers?"
"Actually, they're demi-pachyderms, quite placid, despite their size."
"I know, as a fact, the average demi-pack on this scum world weighs in at 40 tons and has shovel tusks the size of an orc's billhook."
"Indeed. Carl, you asked for my help, and I'm trying. As I sense it, there are 68 of the Baron Slaughtermen coming down the pen track towards you, out for blood. I'm not even counting the angry drovermen with them, or the armed traders coming along for the bounty. I'll pacify the demipacks. Just get across the yard." Carl Thonius sighed and slid back the gate bolt. The sound of it made the herd inside sound and low. Huge hooves trampled forward.
Get
the hell on with it, Carl." Thonius pushed the hefty gate open and slid into the pen. He leaned the gate shut behind him. The demipacks were huge shadows in the chilly night. He could smell their weight, their dung. He could see their snorting breath fuming the cold air. "Carl, let's go." He walked forward. Terror, these things were big. Even in the utter dark, they were monsters. They loomed over him. He could sense their parasite-clotted, wrinkled hides. He edged past 2 or 3, Then one turned its massive head, and he had to duck to avoid collision with a pair of 2-meter tusks.
"I'm dead," he whispered.
"Shut up, Carl. I'm trying to save you here. Keep going. Another 20 paces. What?
One of these things just defecated on me.
It'll wash off, Carl. Come on. Get with me.
I see the gate.
Good. Head for it. Open it.
Head low, Thonius scurried through the forest of legs and distended bellies, hearing their multi-stomach gurgle, smelling their constant gas. He reached the far gate and drew back the slider bolt.
Wait!
Thonius didn't. His heart was fluttering with fear now. He so wanted to be out of the pen, away from the gigantic beasts.
Carl, I...
Thonius pulled the gate open and dashed out into the dry stone corridor outside. He only dimly registered the figures in front of him. He raised his gun as fast as he was able. The slaughterman's face was fixed in a grimace, marked with dried blood. The chain blade sang. The toothed cutter severed Thonius's right arm at the elbow. His whole forearm, the hand still clutching the Hecata Six, flew off into the dark. Kiss heard the scream of pain and outrage.
"Carl! By all that's holy, Carl!"
He'd never been worn. There'd never been a circumstance where it might have to happen. Ravenor didn't even know if Carl Thonius could be worn. But there was no choice. The Wraithbone pendant shone like fire.
Oof! Pain. Excruciating. Dominating. Total. I tried to blank it, but it's overwhelming. Blood's pumping out of my severed arm. I've fallen down. I'm passing out. There's a slaughterman standing over me, his murderous chain blade raised, gore flecking from the cycling teeth. Focus. Focus! This is a surprisingly soft place. Warm. Inviting. Educated. Refined. Thonius's mind space is like a gentleman's club. No, a private dinner party. Every place setting perfect. Every line of discourse wise and ironic. God, Emperor, it's so genteel, so polished. Except for that man at the end of the dining table. The man with the severed arm, spraying blood all over the pressed white tablecloth, screaming, soiling himself. I raise a crystal glass, dignified, and toast. I am the host here. I'm in charge. The man with the shorn-away arm stops screaming. He looks at me, puzzled, like I'm some gate-crasher. We look into each other's eyes for a moment. There's a door behind him in the wood-panelled wall, a door into a secret room. The man really, really doesn't want me to go in there. I don't. There's no time. A brute with a chain blade is about to decapitate me.
Carl Thonius's mutilated body springs up onto its feet and avoids the downstroke of the chain blade. It circles wide and kicks the chain blade's operator in the face, so hard several of his teeth come flying out. Then there's a man with a knife. Even missing a limb, Thonius's body disarms him easily and leaves the knife wedged under his left eye. The other two men have lances, herd lances, with long, broad bronze tips. Thonius's body reaches down into the filth and prizes the Hecata Six from the dead fingers of a severed right arm. Left-handed, it raises the gun. The grip doesn't fit its hand. Who cares? A tight squeeze puts it on auto. The charging spearmen come apart like gristled dolls. Only then do I sink to my borrowed knees, drop the gun, and sag. I've staved off the effects of Thonius's blood loss long enough. Kiss is there. She smiles down at me. She says, "Gonna be fine. I'll get you out of here." And she means it.